welcome. It is Monday night, generational change. I'm Jen.
I'm Peter. And we're looking up.
We're looking up. But in all seriousness, I did spend the past few days, reading the book.
Even if it's being read to you, I guess technically.
I'm into Audible.
I actually like reading the book itself. It's a favorite pastime of mine.
I feel like when I'm doing Audible, I can multitask.
Yeah, I think that that's fair. And the thing is that when you're being read to, it's being read at a consistent pace. Like, I guess in a way, it's kind of easier to take it in versus if you have to read it, there's more of a focus component that comes with
it. Well, yeah, you have to actually sit there and look. But I was interested in, you know, a lot of it with Michael, when it comes to the climate, the environment stuff, I totally agree.
Yes.
But some of the political stuff, which I don't even think we should get into because it's not something that I want to really get into. But
the key lesson in politics is to recognize that there are going to be things with people in certain circles that you're never going to agree with. But if the core issues that we're fighting for are issues that we generally agree on and probably will even more so if we really get to the heart of it, that's really what we need to focus on. You know, it's like the people who still lose their mind over Susan Sarandon, for example, as we know about the whole thing that's been going on social media. And as you know,
she's so powerful.
Yeah, she is. And as we put out the other day, it's like they hate her guts because she's a class traitor. And that just drives certain people in certain.
She's a class traitor.
You know, they really can't stand that. And so when she speaks up on behalf of working people, when everybody else that is at her level financially is saying, just take your medicine and be quiet, that doesn't sit well.
You'll get what you've got coming, and that's
like
it.
And she's not like that. You know, she's at the Julian Assange rally. So I think that's probably the best place for us to start tonight. As you know, major break in the Assange case. He has been granted, I guess what you would call somewhat of a stay of execution, but he is being granted an opportunity to appeal his extradition to the United States by the highest court in the UK. That is huge. What does that effectively mean? It means that essentially, everybody is now telling the U.S. back the hell away. Are they going to? Who knows?
But the problem is that in the meantime, is he still being incarcerated?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's the problem. That's the problem, is that for somebody who has not been charged with any sort of violent crime, why is he being held without bail? This is really the main problem right now, I see. You know, whether or not they get away with it ultimately, that remains to be seen. But why is he still being held? People ask yourselves that.
I think that's a very
good point. Because no, he's being punished. He's being punished for, you know, basically pissing off, you know, our great leaders of the oligarchy. You know, I mean, he pissed off enough people, and that's really all it comes down to. And now they're just punishing him.
Well, again, he's being punished because he crossed the most powerful people in the world. And when that happens, it is going to be a bloodbath. But we've got a lot of things on our table right now that suggest that what Assange did is infinitely bigger than even what he did at the time. We're looking down the barrel of the gun right now at a possible depression, it looks like.
Haven't we known this for like a while that this
yeah,
is
but now
coming?
People
it's inevitable.
Yeah, but it's inevitable in the sense
We're
that people are now starting. Well, yeah, no, I mean, listen, people that can't put food on the table and can't, these seats suck. They're comfortable, but they can't move. You know, the people who can't obviously catch a break, you know, they know what's going on. But the people who have been like sticklers about, oh, it's going to be so much better once we get Biden and the Democrats into office. Yes. No, as we've been talking about, Trump was not the wake-up call. The wake-up call is Joe Biden, because now you're getting to see why Donald Trump got elected in the first place.
I hope that people, I have little faith that people here learn from their mistakes, but we're in a depression. And as somebody who is currently having to deal with like certain home renovations, I can tell you that the price of everything, mm-hmm. the scarcity of everything, everything right now indicates that we're in a really bad way. And this is what I will say, and I am so tired of that, we just needed to elect Joe Biden.
Don't you know everything's better now?
Yeah. every, again, and I'll say it until I'm blue in the face, every single thing that he could do via executive order and fails to do so is a failure on his part. And instead, you're all being distracted by the political theater and circus. But what about the stuff that he could just do with the stroke of a pen? That's the stuff that should be already have happened. That's what's really infuriating to me. I'm so sick of being distracted by Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. Joe could have gotten rid of student loan debt. Joe could decriminalize marijuana. Joe could do a whole bunch of things, and he doesn't.
Yeah.
So you know what? It's like, stop pointing fingers at everybody else. If you think the president has that much power, then how come nobody holds them that accountable?
They don't hold them accountable because it's not in the narrative in order to do that. Something that I saw that was very disturbing the other day. We all know what we think of Brian Stelter. And he decided, I mean, talk about, for anybody who's never seen
Mr. Bill.
For anybody who's never seen Apocalypse Now, there's a great line when Martin Sheen's character and Marlon Brando's character finally meet face to face. One of the first things that Brando says to him is, he says, "You're nothing but an errand boy." And that's what Brian Stelter is. He's an errand boy.
I think of everyone on TV is that, though. Sorry, but I do.
He's at a whole other level, though.
Well, he's an errand boy for the errand boys. He's actually, like, worse because he's the errand boy for the errand boys.
So he's going on national television in a classroom with young children talking about what misinformation is. And I'm just thinking, at what point does this just become a parody of itself? Because it already is, but... like, is this going to be like the Truman Show where eventually they like wink at the camera or something?
I feel like we're there. I look around all the time for cameras. And I'm not saying that in a paranoid way, like I really think people are watching me, but just in a way that things happen that I feel like this has got to be a joke. Like that, that happens. I've often, I'm like,
the disconnect is just so great. And just watching that whole situation, thinking that Brian Stelter is going to be the arbiter of honest reporting and justice. And the fact that they're doing it with these kids.
That's like having Colonel Sanders be an advocate for veganism.
Everywhere you look, there's some distraction. It's like in the state, it's like in our state. Like, we're dealing with this nonsense right now with the good old boy GOP that are trying to prevent not only being able to teach racial history, but now they don't even want you to be able to address sexual orientation.
We're going to get into that story, but I want to be very clear and specific about what the bill says. Like, I don't want to get off on hyperbole. So we're going to actually don't get like general.
We're going to let you handle this.
Well, I want to read it before, you know, we're very specific about what it is before we just jump on a bandwagon and saying, they hate gay people.
Oh, no, I'm not saying
they very well might. They probably do. I don't know. But I don't know what this particular legislation says. So that's what we're going to read.
Well, on the most positive of positive notes, before we do bring in our main guest of the evening, you know Michael E. Mann. You may have known him before Don't Look Up. But of course, when we found that he was the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's character,
it's so
we
funny.
Simply, but at the same time, it's not surprising.
No.
So we actually did something really important today.
Yes, we did.
To the official launch. I hate to say ribbon cutting.
Okay.
Because ribbon cutting is way too politician.
Well, it is, but this is in a very good way. This was very good. It was a ribbon cutting to a community garden that is now being hosted at Hallandale High School, which is amazing. And because it's at a high school, it's safe, protected. It's not going to get gentrified, which is nice. But yeah, I think it was very, but that's for all of you guys helped us do that because we were invited as donors and anyone who is
special people,
we were the special, anybody who donated to their fund got an email invitation to this. But for anybody who supports us, we use that money and do things like support this community garden. So Jen Kaur was a donor. So anybody who supports us, you are also donors of this community garden and it's beautiful.
It's
really cool how they did it. And our friend Vernon Sybil, who is
one of an amazing group of climate activists, permaculture,
gardeners. And he's
great
such, I love him.
Tremendous people. He's a really great guy.
But he's such, like, he was like a kid in the candy store. These are people that live to set up these permaculture gardens and teach the kids. And the fact that it's happening at a school is amazing. We met, basically the entire science department at Hallandale High School has been like really, you know, supporting this. They're so looking forward to it. They've had a butterfly garden for a while there. So this was like a natural sort of transition, but we really need to be using this prototype. And that's something we're going to be working on to push. This is the kind of thing we'd like to see at all schools.
Yeah. And there was one science professor in particular, who I think you were talking to, that really took a shine and is really interested in what we're doing.
Well, you know what? These are people, teachers, it's interesting, but it's like, those are frontline workers.
Oh, yes.
Teachers are frontline workers. These are the people that have the everyday communication with kids, even when parents aren't having that communication, mm-hmm. I think. And especially in an area like this, it's a particularly vulnerable neighborhood. These are kids that they don't even have physics anymore as part of their curriculum.
They don't even have arithmetic anymore.
No, I'm saying like the students at this school definitely get, this is the school that gets the short end, the short straw. This is one of those schools that gets the short straw. And so to see this happening yes. there is extremely inspiring. And the science department is so thankful. And the kids it's a really cool thing.
Not only that, I mean, in terms of our congressional district that Jen ran in, I mean, talk about a district that is of the haves and the have-nots. I mean,
yeah.
especially in East Broward, it is so rough and tough. And what this could do for the school, what it could do for other local communities throughout the area. And we'll leave with this before we bring in Mike. It really says a lot about how everything kind of does happen for a reason. You know, we had a community garden that we were working on in
It was in Liberia.
In the Liberia neighborhood of Hollywood. And because of all the politics that went down. And
we got gentrified.
And we ended up losing it. We ended up having another garden spring up, only this time at a place which it's going to get a lot more fanfare, a lot more notice. And hopefully, which is, of course, our goal, is that this gets duplicated everywhere.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take a lot of space. I think 200 square feet, if I remember correctly.
But it's just amazing. And the truth is that they can work with whatever space any school has. That's the correct. One thing that a lot of schools do have is some space. So,
sure.
Especially here. I mean, I know cities, not all cities have that. But in Florida, Broward, our schools have some space.
And this will be a great topic to talk about with Michael, because, again, I think this is another one of those areas where libertarian conservatives and progressive liberals, if you will, can really find a lot of common ground, because it is all about sustainable culture. And it is, again, a way to reduce our carbon footprint and save money. Again, it all works. It's just a matter of being able to teach people and show them. And I think this is going to be a great way to do that. So without further ado, he is returning to our podcast. He is the author of The Climate War. Is that, and of course he is, yes, he is the inspiration.
Do I get to say that I read it? I never know if I can say that I read it. I listened to it.
It does count. Michael will say that it counts.
All right. I think so. I've gotten extremely liking of people reading to me. People know that now. So I'm an Audible person now. So.
He is also a professor at the university, at Penn State University. He is also, again, the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's character in the Smash Hit movie.
I say atmospheric scientist.
Atmospheric scientist.
Because I think there's a lot of different names and different things that he can address, but I think that makes people understand the best. I think that's the most succinct way to explain to people, because it's complicated. Science is complicated, Michael.
Michael Eman, welcome to Inspirational Change.
Hey, guys, it's great to be back with you. And thanks for that very kind buildup. Actually, the book is The New Climate War.
The New Climate War. Do I get to say I read it if I listen to it?
Well, you know, the person who actually did the audiobook for this book is just wonderful. So actually, it's great to I've heard from a lot of people that they really enjoyed the audiobook version of it. And I would have screwed it up if I had read it myself. And so
you think it when it's the author's voice. Like,
yeah, I know.
Knew it wasn't you. Like when it's someone you don't know who it is, then I guess it might not matter because you don't know their voice. But I like it when it's like Margaret Kimberly did her own, like the last book I read. And it was kind of cool. I felt like I'm getting a private lecture.
Yeah, no, I hear you. He did a great job. And so it's great to be back with you guys.
Yeah. One of the things I love this term, we can just start off with this, because one of the things that we've never labeled people as such, but I love the term inactivists. And this is something that you use throughout that sort of discusses this, what the climate war is, people. It's not as much the climate and us. it's us versus us. Like the fact that the information can't get out there. But will you talk about what is an activist and how do the inactivists work against us?
Well, you know, we used to call them climate change deniers, but that's no longer really an appropriate term because, look, you can't credibly deny that climate change is happening anymore. The forces of inaction, as I call them, fossil fuel interests, the talking heads, politicians, right-wing media outlets that promote their agenda, they can't deny that climate change is happening anymore or that even that we are the cause of it. And so they've turned to this vast array of other tactics to prevent us from moving on because they don't care about the path we take. They just care about the destination. They want us disengaged. And they don't care if it's because we deny that the problem exists or we come to be convinced that it's too late to do anything about it or that we don't need policies. We don't need governments to act. It's just about individuals. We just need to, you know, stop eating hamburgers and that'll solve the problem. Deflection away from the needed policy changes. And it goes on. And even, as I said, doom mongering, despair mongering. If we truly believe it's too late to do anything about the problem, then why do it? And so we have to be on the guard now for these new tactics that are being used. This is the new climate war. These are the tactics that are being used to prevent us from moving on, from getting away from fossil fuels, embracing clean energy, and fundamentally rising to the challenge of addressing this existential threat that we face.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting how the inactivists go from one end to the other and no one even notices it. So they go from it's not happening to it's happening, but there's nothing we can do about it anyway. So it's like, and they just go right through and it's all extremes. But then you have the left extremes where their attitude is, oh, if you're not doing it completely purely this way and 100% this way, then it's not worth even joining together and working with you. And yeah. I find that a lot of that is, I feel it more from the left than I do from, I mean, Republican policy, yes, that's a problem. But I'm talking in terms of like active people that it's more a problem from the left to find a compromise.
Yeah. And the difference, I suppose, is that the people that I think we're talking about here on the left, these are actually good. They're good hearted people. They've been misled. Right. So they're sort of victims of this campaign, this disinformation campaign. And one of the things that the inactivists love to do is to divide us, because if they can get us arguing and fighting with each other, then it divides the climate movement. We no longer speak with, you know, a single voice demanding change. And so there is this sort of divide and conquer, approach that's being used. We see it on social media, trolls and bots that have literally been programmed to get us to argue with each other, to get environmental progressives to argue with each other. And so we have to be on the lookout for that as well. And it's so widespread these days on social media.
Yeah, social media is like a friend and an enemy. It's like on the one hand, I feel like we're able to get our message out and have a platform that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yep.
But then the downside is that there's no accounting for who's out there putting out information and how they're doing it. And I think
you're right. It's been weaponized by the other side. And we just have to, it means we've got to be even more effective in how we use social media.
Yeah, and that's one of the big problems that I don't think people really understand is that a lot of these, even independent media, I mean, we all know what goes on with, the three main corporate conglomerates, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News. But even when we're looking at what's happening with independent media channels, you know, they have sponsors that are part of the fossil fuel industry. And if they have a directive that is going to go with, you know, a channel like, let's say, Steven Crowder, you know, they are going to espouse a certain message that suggests, oh, there's nothing you could do about it anyway. Hey, here's your $5,000 a week check for basically BSing the hell out of people. And what's a $5,000 a week check to somebody with that type of platform? It's literally pennies on the dollar for them. Yeah. And so this is the big fight that we're facing now. And so I think it's just a great transition right into, obviously, this movie that has really shook up quite a few people. They you saw You know, David Sirota is a friend, and, you know, he's been on the show, and he mentioned how the reaction was exactly what he was hoping he would get. He would get the ample panic that was already there from the progressive left and even more environmentally conservative people. But the neoliberal establishment got really upset about it. And he's like, okay, yeah, this is what we were hoping would happen. And so what was the inspiration behind you basically being the centerpiece of Mr. DiCaprio's character?
Because he's Henny Penny. Henny Penny. That's why.
Well, you know, it's I don't want to claim too much credit here, and I know David as well, and I think that Adam and David, you know, worked together to create this masterful narrative, right? And it was, I think it was Dave. In fact, David and I did a segment on MSNBC a few weeks ago. And it was really interesting to sort of to be talking about it side by side with him. And I also did this this interview with Adam McKay that was posted this week on a couple sites. It was part of Netflix's sort of promotion campaign. Mm-hmm. And so it was really interesting to talk with them. And I had some ideas about what I thought they were trying to accomplish, but it was really interesting to run those past them and to hear them confirmed, in essence. And one of the things that's really interesting, I think, and I think David gets the credit, as I understand it, it was his idea to use a comet. It was just some casual conversation that they were having. Like, what if a comet were, you know, coming to, you know, towards Earth, hurtling towards Earth? You know, how would we react? Can we, you know, can we somehow use that device that is sort of devoid of a lot of the political baggage that climate change has acquired now, because it's become a partisan issue? If you're a faithful Republican, you are supposed to deny the basic evidence, the reality of the threat. The script was written before COVID-19, before the pandemic, which is sort of remarkable because it's also a sort of a perfect metaphor for what we've seen, yeah. How ideologically motivated anti-science has gotten in the way of us confronting this problem. And I think the idea of using a comet here that's coming towards Earth is that, hey, can't we all, at least across the ideological spectrum, agree that we would want to work together to stop this? Is that what it would take? And, you know, I think the idea is to get people to sort of think about this in a way that is removed from the political baggage that is now attached to the climate crisis. And maybe to get some of those people to realize how absurd their position is, some of those neoliberals that you're talking about. And I really like the way that they take to task, you know, these sort of technocrats, these techno billionaires.
Oh, like, yeah.
You're jumping ahead.
Oh, all right. I love that so much. That character to me was some sort of weird morph of like Elon Musk, Bill Gates, and Jeff Bezos kind of thing.
That's exactly.
Don't forget Zuckerberg. Don't, because he's in there too.
Right, right. Like, just this weird. And the fact that it's so like the priority is not saving Earth. We don't need to save Earth. We need to grab this so that we can make money off of it because of its resources. And everybody just was like, yeah, you know, all right, sure. And I think that really is what we're seeing. We're just seeing it in slow motion. But that's what we're seeing with the climate. That's a good segue to talk about how there's like the people who seem like they're on our side, but they're not on our side, and they're just seeking profit in another way.
One of the worst things about the whole Trump phenomenon and the way that the ire was directed at him, and listen, it justifiably so in many instances, but that ire at that level needs to be directed at people like Musk and Bezos and Gates and Zuckerberg. And as of right now, it isn't.
No.
And because it isn't, that's why this continues to spiral out of control. If we don't get to the consensus of these men are not benevolent, they have simply figured out a way to completely game the system, and that's why they are where they are, because that's the truth.
Yeah. So let's talk. I mean, because that was something in the book that was really interesting to me was that
the savior isn't a whole bunch of old white billionaires. They're not going to come and save us. Old white male billionaires.
Honestly, the ending makes perfect sense. It's like, oh, there are people who will be saved. Just, you know,
not for long. No. And they deserve that.
By the ending, do you mean the nominal ending or the end credit scene at the very end?
I haven't seen that yet. So don't tell. I know that it says, I haven't seen. No, we're
you have to watch the whole thing. All the way to the end credit.
Well, they have the right idea. And if Sirota was basically the one who wrote it, was this idea of, we have all of these problems right now, all of these problems. And you guys are spending $500 million how many billions of dollars
flying penis rocket ships
up to the sky as a joyride.
Michael, will you tell us about the people that are our frenemies?
Yeah, so no, I'm glad that the conversation's moved in this direction, because this was really important for me. This has been a pet peeve of mine, more than a pet peeve. It's something that's really stuck in my craw. The way that these sort of tech billionaires are now framing this as a problem that we can just engineer our way out of it. And, we should have realized something was up when Rex Tillerson was advertising geoengineering as the way to solve the climate crisis. If the CEO of the world's largest publicly traded fossil fuel company, ExxonMobil, thinks that geoengineering is the solution, then we should probably be wary. We should understand that, why does he like geoengineering? Because it's a license to continue to burn fossil fuels and pollute, or they see it as a license to do so. And it was just a study. You guys might've seen the headlines that came out today. And I'm trying to remember where the piece appeared. It might've been a piece in The Guardian. This one carbon capture and sequestration project that was funded by Shell, that was supposed to be a proof of concept, actually ends up producing more carbon pollution than it captures and sequesters. And it just really drives home the fact that these things, there's not even a proof of concept for doing this at scale, carbon capture and sequestration, but it gives them a talking point. As long as they can say, oh, we'll capture and sequester the carbon, it's sort of a way to steer the conversation away from the tough political decisions that we need to make now to solve the problem the only reliable and safe way to stop burning fossil fuels. So it's a convenient sort of crutch for polluters. And I thought that they captured it so well. Even the fact, and I think there was a lot of Bill Gates in that, because Bill Gates is funding this geoengineering research.
Yep. He freaks me out the most,
I think he might be the most dangerous.
I do. He's trying to control the world food supply.
Yeah, with all the, he owns like a half a billion acres or something
in Africa
of land.
Stuff. That's
yes, I can only speak to sort of the climate stuff, but it's certainly the case that he has used his massive platform, and his book came out, a month after mine, and he got a lot more attention for it. And he was promoting what I thought was just a very wrongheaded approach. He downplays the role that existing renewable energy can play now, and in so doing ends up sort of bolstering these much riskier paths, geoengineering, massive carbon capture. And to me, this guy, Peter, I'm going to forget the name of the actor, Peter, in the movie.
I was looking up
Peter Isherwell.
He was the name of the character, but the guy's name.
The actor.
The actor is a Brit. It's Mark Rylance.
I thought he sort of, I'm a big fan of Leo's and Jennifer Lawrence's, but I thought he sort of steal the show.
It was so creepy. It's really good. Oh yeah.
He really made the character as creepy as the character should be.
Yes. And
not enough people find them creepy enough. People revere wealth. And that's, to me, it's like there's people that are not held accountable because somehow they're viewed as that we live in a meritocracy and they earned that money.
Right.
And so therefore they are worthy of more respect because they are that much better than us.
Right.
And it's really creepy. And I find all of that with Bill Gates. It's very, people don't even know what the geothermal engineering is. So if you would just talk about, because I mean, we're throwing it around, but it occurs to me that a lot of people might not know what that is and how insanely creepy it is. This is where people are messing with the climate and our weather, basically.
And the last thing I'll mention before you continue, Michael, is that the thing about this movie is that for the politicos, the people that, especially in the climate movement, that really understand what's going on, we caught all of the Easter eggs that were in this movie. Whereas a lot of people who don't follow politics closely, like so much of this stuff is going to go completely over the head. I agree. You're not going to know what's going on.
There are layers and layers of, you know, of context there that that are important. And, you know, it was it's funny. It's sort of, I suppose, you know, I have mixed feelings about, you know, the notion. So Leo did name check me when he was asked about, you know, what inspired this role. And that's what's led to the, you know, the idea that the character was based on me, but in a very loose way. I think, you know, what Leo meant there was the struggles that those of us who've been trying to communicate the crisis, you know, for decades now, and come up against the same sort of obstacles that you see the characters come up against, the scientists come up against in the film. I think that's where he was drawing upon sort of his experiences talking to me and other scientists. But I want to be very clear that all the marital infidelity and all the
I was going to ask you about your relationship with is that supposed to be like Mika Brzezinski?
Yes.
I have been on Morning Joe a few times, but I promise. I promise, Joe, nothing.
Sexual relations with his wife.
I promise it never happened. It's a pretty good Bill Clinton.
He does a good Bill.
Yeah. No, you know, I promised Joe that, you know, nothing untoward has happened. And so.
But they actually made, and I think Cate Blanchett's beautiful. That movie creeped me out how they made her look, because like she really looked plastic.
It was amazing, really scary.
And I actually, I'm not like a fan of Morning Joe, but Mika doesn't look like that. Like she's much more, I mean, they took it to the extreme, but it was. Right. Like for me to find Cate Blanchett really unattractive is a serious feat.
Well, you know, they did. And her co-host played by
Tyler Perry.
Yeah. Tyler Perry, who's just great. I thought they just, they were obviously a caricature of these sort of morning show folks, and the set sort of had like a Morning Joe feel to it, but I think they were drawing upon, you know, more generic sort of these happy Pollyannish sort of morning show hosts who don't want to engage about these topics in a meaningful way. You know, it's just all light and fluffy to keep their, you know, advertisers happy and to keep their viewers watching. And it's they really did capture the absurdity of it all. And the fact that, you know, there literally could be a comet heading our way. And if the Republicans felt that they could benefit from denying the comet, they would do so if they had. And, you know, and we're seeing that now with the pandemic, and we're seeing that with climate change denial. And, yes, you know,
I think the difference is the Democrats, they're the people that they'll let you look at it, but they'll find a way to make a profit off of helping you deal with it. Like somebody will sell some sort of umbrella that'll keep it from falling on your head.
And then on the other
side, let's just say that there, you know, there are at least a couple Democrats who have been extremely unhelpful. I would argue Democrats in name only who have been extremely unhelpful. And, you know, I've talked to some of these folks. There really are a bunch of folks in the Democratic Party whose heart is in the right place, but they become trapped by the system. They, you know, we're seeing that right now. We're seeing that you can buy off the Koch brothers, you know, have very cleverly bought off a couple Democrats, and that's all they needed to do to block any meaningful climate legislation. So yeah, there's some blame on both sides, but at the same time, you know, the Republican Party has been in bed with the fossil fuel industry for decades. And if we're looking for a villain, you know, that's where
the fossil fuel industry. Well, we think of them and the military industrial complex as like the big bad guys as far as climate crisis. But Yeah. So would you just please explain geothermal engineering? And,
Well, let me be very clear. Geothermal energy is actually, I don't mean to quibble with you.
No,
that's
please.
That's a good thing. That's renewable energy.
Right.
What you mean, you're talking about geoengineering, and the terminology can get very confusing. It gets confusing.
This is why we need you to explain it. This is why.
It's so confusing.
My professor, you're on the clock right now.
So geoengineering, as we call it, is literally manipulating our environment in some other way in an effort to somehow offset the warming effect of carbon pollution. And it varies from, you know, schemes that literally involve shooting particles into the stratosphere, sulfur dioxide pollution to form particulates that are reflective, to reflect some of the sun back to space, to offset the warming effect of greenhouse gases. When you start to look at these schemes, when you use climate models to look at, you know, what if we actually did this? What you find is that it's very unlikely that it would offset the effect of carbon pollution. You might be able to prevent the average temperature of the planet from changing, but you would do so by making some areas warm faster, some areas cool. You would change the atmospheric circulation in a way that would probably dry out the continents. And by the way, that sulfur pollution would be worsening acid rain and ozone depletion. So it's the principle of unintended consequences. If you start manipulating in a massive and uncontrolled and unprecedented way, this system that we don't understand perfectly, the law of unintended consequences tells us that we could very well end up making things even worse off. Now, carbon capture is a sort of a milder form of geoengineering. Here, the idea, like, it's called direct air capture. That's to be distinguished from like carbon capture and sequestration is when like you take a coal-fired power plant and you try to basically capture the carbon pollution before it makes its way into the atmosphere, and you react it with stuff and bury it somewhere. And, you know, who knows? It may stay there or it may make its way back out. That's carbon capture and sequestration. Some people would say that's not really geoengineering. You're not really manipulating the larger climate system, sort of operating at a local scale, at the scale of this coal, you know, power plant, for example. But there's also what's known as direct air capture. And you basically create these synthetic structures. They're like artificial trees that are supposed to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And you would need billions of these. I mean, to do this at the scale that would be necessary is almost impossible to imagine how difficult a task that would be. And so in this case, it probably wouldn't hurt us in the same way that like this sulfate aerosol geoengineering or some of these, or dumping iron into the oceans to try to fertilize the algae to get them. A lot of these things could create all sorts of unintended consequences. This direct air capture, you're sort of trying to get the genie back into the bottle. You're trying to solve the problem sort of at its source. But again, it would be very difficult to do this at scale. And more likely, it's just going to be used as an excuse by technocrats who say, look, trust us. We'll work this out. We'll get this technology working. 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we'll suck all this carbon back out of the atmosphere. So let us continue to mine and sell and burn fossil fuels in the meantime, because we've got this. We'll fix it for you. We promise. And I think that that's sort of what's so effectively satirized in the film, that sort of thinking.
Yeah, like that if we just throw enough money at this problem, we'll make it go away. And that's, I mean, yeah, well, money at the problem will help, but not in the way that they're going to be able to just vanquish it like just that. But,
yeah. And so to complete the analogy, by the way, just to complete the analogy, yeah. Bill Gates has for-profit companies to do this stuff. So it's an almost perfect analogy with the example.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Michael E. Mann, author of The New Climate War and professor at Penn State University. I think it's very important that we talk about what do we do now? What is the next step? Because this movie, Don't Look Up, has probably been seen by maybe a quarter billion people at this point. I mean, there are a lot of people that have seen this movie. So if you are talking to the layperson, somebody who is not a politico like the three of us are that follow this stuff intently, and somebody who just saw this is like, man, this is scary. What do I do now? Yeah. Okay, so what are your recommendations to say this is what we need to do over the next decade, let's say?
Yeah. So thanks. That's a really important question, because I think some people will take the film the wrong way. And I've seen that reaction. I've seen people who came away from it very dispirited. It's like, oh my God, there's nothing we can do. That's not really what Adam and David were saying. And they wanted us to understand the obstacles right in our way right now. And the wrong turns, the dead ends, the dangerous, you know, paths that we shouldn't take, like geoengineering, because if we do that, we forestall the opportunity to save this problem, to solve this problem safely, right? If we believe the sort of technocrats who tell us we can geoengineer our way out of this problem 10 years from now, 20 years from now, then it leads us down a path where we do become now dependent on that working, because we lose, there's the opportunity cost by not having acted enough to move away from fossil fuels in the near term. We will have lost the opportunity to solve the problem safely if we listen to these technocrats that want to geoengineer our way out of this problem down the road and made promises that we, you know, and are profiting from it, are actually profiting from those ventures themselves. So that's what I think Adam and David are. Don't fall for it. We've got to solve this problem now the safe way. And that's going to mean some, you know, some difficult choices. That's going to mean, you know, first of all, our politics, right? If we're going to solve the climate crisis, we've got to solve the crisis right now with American democracy, because without our ability to lead on this issue, the other countries of the world won't come to the table. We won't solve this if the United States isn't taking a leadership position. And right now, we've got, you know, politicians who are standing in the way of legislation. You know, a lot of us would have liked to have seen an expansive Green New Deal, something like that. That's not what we're going to get, but we're still hoping we can get these climate provisions in the Build Back Better bill that will allow us to make good on our commitment to lower our carbon emissions in the U.S. by 50% this decade. That's what Biden has promised to the rest of the world. If he can't deliver, then we lose credibility and this all starts to fall apart. And in order for him to deliver, well, right now we're blocked by a couple of Democrats, right, that have sided with Republicans. We've got to change that. We need such a large proportion of progressive, members of Congress that it doesn't come down to one or two easily bought out, conservative Democrats, that there are large progressive majorities that will allow us to pass bold, expansive climate legislation. We've got to turn out. We've got to vote in these midterms. We've got to motivate young folks, particularly who are victims of sort of cynicism, this idea that there's no difference and there's no reason to vote. If we continue to think that way, then we're going to continue to see these, these obstacles. We'll continue to face these obstacles to doing anything, to passing anything legislatively in the U.S. We can act at the local level, at the state level. We've got to make all that progress, do everything you can. Yeah, lower your own carbon footprint. Do everything you can to sort of decrease your own environmental impact. But understand it can't stop there. We need policies. We need incentives. We need politicians who are willing to do what's right for us, rather than politicians who are simply helping polluters make larger profits.
You bring up a very important point that, and I do want to touch on. Speaking of President Biden, you know, one of the things that I don't think it's talked about enough is the power of the executive office and what President Biden would be capable of doing, even if it has to go around the legislative branch, separate but equal branches of government.
Yeah.
And in the case of the commander in chief, he has the ability to 86 all of these oil drilling permits. And unfortunately, in his first year in office, he's issued almost 1,000 more than Trump did in his first year. And the trajectory of where this is going is very dangerous. Now, it's not a question, again, do I think that there are more Democrats who care about the environment than Republicans? Absolutely. That's not even up for debate. However, there needs to be some type of an aggressive push with the president to say, we've got, if anybody can lead with precedent right now, it's you. Because if Manchin and Sinema are going to do their thing, that's the way it's going to be. But that's not going to stop you from stepping up and saying, okay, this is something that you are actually able to do. And I think that that's something we could focus on and maybe get somewhere with. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of us would like to see more fight when it comes to these battles. And there's just a little too much, you know, you've got one party that's engaging completely in bad faith. It's Lucy and the football, right? The Republicans are never going to engage in good faith. And you've got conservative courts right now. So part of the problem, you know, Biden has tried to sort of, you know, use executive authority to stop, you know, these, you know, stop new pipelines on public lands, that sort of stuff, Keystone XL pipeline. But he's facing now opposition from, you know, 4 years of Trump means the courts are loaded with these ideologue conservatives and they are ruling against the administration. Now, some people would argue, and I think it's a reasonable argument, that the administration is rolling over too easily, that they're not really pushing. Look, the Republicans absolutely have pushed the limits. Talk about pushing the limits of executive authority. Trump tried to stage a coup to stay in power. How could you abuse executive authority any more than what Trump has done? So Democrats shouldn't abuse their executive authority, but they should assert it and they should be willing to test it. And I think we don't see enough fight. I think there's a feeling that we're not seeing enough fight. We're still, you know, Democrats like Biden are still caught in this mindset. Like, can't we just get along? You can't negotiate with terrorists, right? And that's what the Republican Party now is. They're the equivalent of terrorists in the way that they're dealing with climate and everything.
Environmental terrorists. I think that is a fair.
I don't think it's an unfair thing to say.
You can't see everything going to hell and then think that you can't do something about it because you know that they can do something about it. And speaking of which, this is going to be a very ugly midterm election year. We all know that. But Pennsylvania is going to be what I think one of the two or three most important states, consequential states, when it comes to the elections this year. And so I'm curious from your perspective, because obviously this is going to be a very contentious primary. You got Dr. Oz running for the Senate on the Republican side, which I get just it's the clown show and it just keeps rolling along. But you have three very interesting candidates who are vying for the U.S. Senate nomination, Malcolm Kenyatta in Philadelphia, Connor Lamb in Pittsburgh, and then in Pennsylvania, as we like to say, you've got John Fetterman, who is the lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
How do you see this race shaping out? And obviously, who do you think of the three candidates would be the most favorable regarding the environmental push that a state like Pennsylvania can really play a significant role in?
Yeah, so I know Malcolm personally. I really like him a lot. I think he'd be great. I have resisted sort of making any sort of endorsement in the primary. That's just that has been my policy in the past to sort of stay out of the primaries, let them battle it out, and then when there's a candidate, I endorse the progressive who emerges from that process. So I haven't, you know, made an endorsement there. Fetterman, of course, has amazing name recognition. He plays well in some of the more conservative parts of the state. So I think there's this feeling that he's a really competitive candidate. I really like Malcolm a lot. And so, you know, I'm not going to make an endorsement. I would be happy, frankly, if either of them were to emerge from that process. Now, you know, I am not yet willing to concede that Republicans are going to regain control of Congress. I think there's some real wild cards here that we're not fully taking into account right now. There's the fact that we're coming out of the latest wave of the pandemic. The numbers are really starting to come down. So, you know, a month or two from now, when the the cases and fatalities are way down, and we can start maybe once again to sort of return to something that feels a bit more like normal life, I think that'll have a huge psychological impact. I think that'll bolster Biden's popularity, and that will have coattail effects, for other Democrats, especially if it accompanies some blockbuster developments with this, this January, 6th, these hearings that we will see play out over the next several months on the insurrection. I think the stuff that may come out may open some eyes. Some people right now who have been sort of waffling or have sided with sort of, the Republicans, moderate conservatives, moderate Republicans, the stuff that may come out may make them uncomfortable voting for that party. And so I am not yet willing to write off the midterms. I think we have to do everything we can. Here's my fear. If we lose, if the Republicans regain control of one or both houses of Congress, the destruction that they are doing to our democracy right now may become irreversible. It may become impossible to defeat them because of the, election interference policies that they're putting in place. The voter, intimidation sort of policies that they are implementing. I fear that if we lose our democracy to them, we don't get it back. And if we don't have our democracy, we don't have any potential for acting on things like the climate crisis. Our entire politics will become a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate interests. And we know where that goes.
I wanted to get back to your book a little bit and point out for people that while you do talk about the problems with the nihilism and the doomsday and the, if it's going to happen anyway, whatever.
Right.
But yet it is happening. And so we need to be sort of in this balance between recognizing the gravity of the situation.
Yeah.
And there's a fine line between that and being
That's
doomsday.
Right.
And then there's a very practical question about, so we know that as individuals, we can reduce our carbon footprint, but we are not to be taken in and fooled by messages that it's all on us. Because the reality is, if we all drove electric cars tomorrow, people, that's not going to solve the problem.
Right.
So it can't just be us. But we do have a specific question, and it's kind of something I've wanted to know.
Yeah.
The first one about the
this one here?
Yeah, the carbon footprint of this in terms of overall resources and energy use to source lithium and build EVs, what do you think the net positives in actual energy resources savings are, if any? And let me also add the caveat, presuming most people plug their car into a home on the grid.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so, we had Paul Glick on, and he plugs his car into his house that's off the grid. So great. Okay. But most people are still on the grid. So go with the assumption that they're on the grid.
Yeah. I mean, so this is why, electric vehicles, I mean, there's some savings there, even if they're running off the grid, just because they're more efficient than, internal combustion engine cars. So you get some gain in efficiency. But the real gain is when you decarbonize the grid. So, when you're getting your power, as we do, from wind, right now we pay extra. And so we have a power, an electricity plan where all of our power is coming from renewable energy, from wind in the state of Pennsylvania. And you can pay more to do that. You shouldn't have to pay more to do that. Why should you have to pay more for electricity that's better for the planet?
So hey, at least you have the option.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
I ain't no pragmatist, but it's like, hey, at least you got something. I mean,
where are you located?
You're in
We're in Florida, my friend.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So you don't have that option in Florida, right?
No, now. and it's not even. And you got, and this is again, this is the whole thing about the two party duopoly.
We live in the sunshine state. You know, there's no solar. And
it's I know. This is the irony,
yeah,
right?
No, because it's not, because everyone thinks this is a DeSantis thing and all that. Yeah. No, the reality is that we have an energy monopoly. NextEra Energy, which is one of the most powerful fossil fuel companies in the world, they own FPNL, Florida Power and Light. And they are our energy monopoly. Yeah. You cannot use anybody other than them. And that's how...
It's not a DeSantis thing, people. I swear, we've been having this vital, for years.
And don't get me wrong. The things... It isn't even DeSantis. The things that Rick Scott did as governor to empower FPNL.
Oh, yeah.
Were incredible.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the whole thing about the after effect. It's like... A policy could be put in place and you're not going to feel it until like a decade later. And now more than ever, we are in a situation where two things, Big Sugar and FPNL, and we have to deal with them here. In a state like Pennsylvania, thank goodness, you at least have that option.
Yeah, that's
right. We would like to at least have something else. But as it stands right now, you know, we don't. And that's something we're working
on. So it's worth it then. But so the emissions alone, when you switch over, because I have a plug-in hybrid, but I use very little gas because I don't usually go that far every day.
Yeah.
So
if you're mostly doing commuting, then you're mostly doing it off of the battery. And
but I'm plugged into a grid that's whatever it is what I
know. I hear you. I hear you.
So, but it's still worth it.
It's still worth it. But we will, decarbonize the grid. And when Rick Scott was sort of handpicked by the Koch brothers and laid the groundwork for what you're now reaping in Florida, you're absolutely right. And so it's going to take quite a bit of time and effort to undo, what's been done there. But that eventually that's what we want to see. We want to see incentives that, not only you can elect to get, your electricity from renewables. You can put up solar panels, you can do things you can take yourself off the grid, and that's one way to do it. But the grid itself should be renewably powered. There's no reason we shouldn't be doing that. And so, if you're like we are, we're paying extra, but we get our energy, is coming from wind. So we're charging our cars off of wind. We've got two plug-in hybrid cars, and so all of our commuting is done on battery, and the battery is charged off of wind, and so we're not burning any fossil fuels to do all of our commuting. But it's important to us. The point is that it should be cheaper. It shouldn't matter whether or not you shouldn't have to consciously decide. I want to do something that's better for the planet. Many of us will do that because we know it's the right thing to do, but some people won't. And we need even people who don't care about the environment to be making decisions that are better for the rest of us, that are better for the planet.
Michael, one final topic that I want to touch upon, and this is actually a fairly reasonable conservative argument about how to deal with the environment, which is also economic as well. And that is the argument of centralized planning versus decentralized planning. I've been to different parts of the country, especially out west, and especially in places where there's not a lot of population. And it is amazing how much different it is when you breathe in the air. You can tell the difference when you're breathing clean air. Down here in Florida, we don't really get to breathe much.
You don't roll your windows down here.
Yeah. But, even when I went to the Joshua Tree National Park in Palm Springs, California, it's like you breathe in that air and you're like, wow, this is what clean environment is supposed to be like.
For now.
Right. Right.
And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on one of the major issues when it comes to the formation of so much carbon emission, which is basically having people, stacked on top of each other, problem that we have here in South Florida. What are your thoughts on the living circumstances that we have here in this country and what we could do to mitigate that problem?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot we can do improve the environment in urban spaces, especially. And, here you have urban heat islands, right? So, and you tend to have people who live in some of the, most environmentally degraded urban localities tend to be lower income. They tend to be minorities. And so, you know, we talk about climate justice and we talk about environmental justice and the fact that the people who are most subject to the detrimental impacts of pollution and climate change, those urban heat island, and there's a good friend of mine, a colleague of mine, Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, who's done a lot of research in looking at microclimates and is able to show that a lot of, I mean, you can actually zoom in and see that areas, low-income areas with large minority populations, typically are more prone to flooding, suffer more from extreme urban heat in the summer. And so this is a justice issue, right? We often talk sort of casually about environmental justice and climate justice, and we don't always say what that means, but this is what it means. The people who are most subject to the damaging impacts of environmental pollution and climate change are those who had the least role in creating the problem, those with the least resources, and those with the least political power today. And of course, we're seeing that now with efforts to prevent, you know, in particular, African Americans from being able to vote right now, all these laws being passed in the various red states. And so, you know, this is an issue of justice, and we have to see it that way. And acting on climate is acting on social justice. We have to see these things as intertwined.
I also think it's important to say that this is not just a domestic thing. Like when we look globally and yep. in places like the global South,
India.
Well, yep. it is. It's the people in the countries that that contribute the least to the problem
right.
are suffering the most. Like those countries in terms of the storms, the infrastructure, I mean,
oh, yeah.
food, famine, all of it.
Yeah, I mean, most the African countries, the average person, you know, in Ghana or Tanzania has a carbon footprint that's, you know, 100 times smaller than a typical American carbon footprint. And so they've played the least role in creating the problem. And just as you say, because they have the least wealth and the least infrastructure, they are more, you know, exposed to the damaging impacts of climate change. So however you look at it, urban versus, you know, if you look at it in terms of the urban poor and minority populations within the United States, if you look at it around the world, or if you look at it intergenerationally, the people who will bear the brunt of the decisions we're making today are people who you know, our young folks, people who haven't even been born yet and have no say, they have no vote right now. And we're making decisions, you know, the impacts of which are going to fall largely on them if we don't act.
Yeah. What are you working on right now? Where can people find you if they want to check
Everyone
out
needs to check out
work?
The book. You
yes.
guys, and it is on Audible. It's not Michael narrating it, but it
yes.
is
so
on Audible.
So if you're lazy and you can't read and you need someone to
I don't consider it lazy.
And I hear you. Audiobooks a great way to catch up. I do a lot of it myself. We've got another book, the second edition of a children's book that I co-authored.
Cool.
Nice.
The tantrum.
It's not like doom. You call it doom climate porn. What did you?
Climate doom porn
for children.
No, so this is entirely the opposite. This is an empowering tale of a girl. It's a book that I co-authored with Megan Herbert, who's a children's illustrator and author. And we actually published it back in 2016, sort of before the youth climate movement really appeared on the scene. And so it's a little bit of life imitating art. It's this story about a girl who throws this tantrum because all these displaced animals, polar bear, a swarm of bees, tigers, animals that have been displaced by climate change and people who have been displaced by climate change are showing up at her door. And she throws a tantrum. She's very upset about this, but it evolves into this very empowering, you know, her ultimately becoming the change that she wishes to see in the world and holding, you know, politicians accountable for doing something about this problem. So the first edition was limited. We only had 2,000 copies. My co-author, Meg Herbert, sort of self-published it. Now we've got a major distributor, Penguin, appropriately Penguin Random House in mid-March will be widely available. It's just a great story. If you've
What's
got children
called?
Or cousins or what have you, The Tantrum That Saved the World.
The Tantrum That Saved the World.
And it's a little bit like a Dr. Seuss sort of tale. And it's, you know, it's just, and it's a nice way you can read it to, you know, the young folks in your life. And it's not doom and gloom. Yeah, it's urgency. It's hopefully instilling in them an understanding of the urgency, but also, as I like to say, providing the agency, you know, the path forward to actually do something about it.
That's awesome. Kids should know this. It's sad that they have to know this, but they have to know this now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, The Lorax, you know, my parents read The Lorax to me when I was a young child, and it really had an impact on the way that I viewed the world. And so maybe, you know, that's what we're trying to do, a little bit of that now.
Yeah. Does not. Did you see the movie, by the way, The Lorax? Like, it was only like 10 years ago or so. Did you see it?
I did. It's, you know, it's like, you know, when they turn it into a movie, there's this whole elaborate plot that has nothing to do with the original.
Yes, but the guy who owns the air, that sells the air, is that not Jeff Bezos? Like, he is the guy who's going through and just turning everything into a thing. Like, I just...
Yeah, the Wensler.
The Wensler.
Yeah.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, there's some parallels there, I have to say. You know, Jeff Bezos, if you're watching, you got to get your act together. But yeah, and stop the you know, the phallus shaped space. You know, there's just, you know,
that's serious. That is some serious Freudian expression there, if there ever was.
I also think of him as Lord Farquaad from Shrek, but you've never
seen Shrek. I can definitely see
Michael. You have kids, right?
I have a daughter who's amazingly now already 16 years old. She's going to be driving pretty soon. So it happens very quickly, but
so
yeah.
You've seen the series, because he doesn't have kids. He never saw a series. So, you know, take him and they put him in the fake legs because he's so small. That's Jeff Bezos. He needs fake legs.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a, you know, look, you can trace a lot of the Napoleon complex to a lot of these individuals, unfortunately.
Oh, my God.
With that said, Michael E. Mann, the book is The New Climate War, and his soon-to-be-released book this spring, The Tantrum That Saved the World. The inspiration for Don't Look Up. We hope to see you again real soon, my friend. Thank you.
Bye, Michael.
Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Bye-bye, brother.
Bye-bye.
So, as one would imagine,
he was lovely,
as you like to say. but you know, again, we're looking at these things through a very specific lens. And look, guys, you know, for those that are watching, look, I tried to push him, particularly on this idea that it's all about the Republicans and, you know, it's got nothing to do with the, you know, what the Democrats are doing. I mean, look, the reality is they both suck.
Well, before we started, I specifically said, like, and I just listened to the book. And yes, I do. When it comes to the political aspect of it,
right,
that's not something that I'm necessarily going to see eye to eye with him on. But fortunately for us, what he is an atmospheric scientist. And what he really knows about is science and climate crisis. So that's the information that I choose to absorb from someone like him.
No, 100%.
And that's what we need to do. So it isn't so much who he blames or who, that's really neither here nor there. We can create our own villains in our head,
but
whether
they're
Russian or not.
No, and what I will...
They're not Russian bots.
Well, that doesn't mean that we are not involved. They don't know what we've been up to. And you know that we're going to start World War III with Ukraine.
I don't want to talk about the Ukraine. It's very upsetting. You know what pisses me off the most about the Ukraine? Do you notice where everyone's talking? This is something that I have to say. It's about the U.S. and Russia, right? Nobody's talking about the Ukraine. Like, what did they want? What did they, like, this is what's so infuriating to me, is it's a people playing stratego, and we're talking about a war regarding a country that really doesn't seem to be having a say-so. I don't know. I find the whole thing just ridiculous posturing and a pissing match and just an excuse.
The problem that we're dealing with here, and this is one of the things that, like I said, I wasn't going to get into, you know, I mean, look, I pushed Michael. I'm not going to push him any harder than I did.
There's no point,
because it derails the conversation.
There's no point.
But the overwhelming majority of the contributions that these tech billionaires, these Uber billionaires, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Mark Zuckerberg, they donate to Democrats. They do not donate to Republicans. Now, there are the billionaire Republicans that are part of the problem.
Of course.
But what we have here, and the Koch brothers are still immensely the worst that is out there in that regard, we have a huge problem with corporate special interest money running our government and running our representatives.
And it doesn't matter which party.
Doesn't matter.
But here is the thing, and this is a big point that he made in the book, regarding the at least supposed policy, there is. But then you look at what you're saying as far as the amount of oil that has been being permits that have been being issued, and it really is. So the real difference is how it's portrayed to us, because we really don't know.
And this is one of the reasons why I think 2024 is going to be very interesting, regardless of what happens in the midterms, because I think it's going to be a really, really long shot, if we're being honest here, that Biden is going to run again. I just don't see it. I know he has to keep up appearances right now, but for the next 10 months, 11 months, he has to say that he's running again.
I'm not feeling it.
Once he gets to the midterms, obviously the narrative will change. And so what we're looking at here is an opportunity to really highlight the fact that the commander-in-chief really does have a lot of power regarding the environment and what they can do to mitigate the problem, or at least deal with it in some capacity.
And yet it's not happening.
If you are issuing oil drilling permits, you do not have to do this. Remember, you don't have to issue more oil drilling permits.
Well, you do when you're the bitch of the industry. That's what they pay you for. That's what they're paying you for, right, Joe? See, again, every single thing that he's capable of doing via executive order that he doesn't do is a failure.
Correct.
Every single thing.
You can blame.
And listen,
we like Michael a lot, but it's easy to just blame Sinema and Ranchin. And not to say that they're devoid of responsibility. They are certainly. This idea that President Biden couldn't take Joe Manchin in a back room and say, you're going to get on board with this, or I'm going to prosecute your daughter and put her in jail for the rest of her life. And he could do that because she is a criminal. She is a criminal of the highest order. She is a multimillionaire many times over, at the detriment of thousands and thousands of victims.
Have you ever noticed that the people who steal out of need and desperation get punished infinitely more than the people who steal for sport? It's for sport.
Oh, yeah.
Because people like Manchin's daughter, that's not stealing to live. And yet the majority of our prison system is full of people that have committed crimes of poverty out of desperation and need. And those people get sentenced to years and years, and people like her get nothing. And she was just doing it for fun.
Matt, fair enough. Fair enough. There's always got to be a rotating villain, as we say in politics.
Oh, no. We agree with that completely. It could be whoever it is. You're right. That's how you know it's bullshit.
They're willing to take the slings and arrows.
And
so to say that the president simply can't do anything is just to feed the narrative of the vote blue, no matter who are dye-in-the-wool Democrats who think everything is the problem of the GOP.
It's WWE to me.
It is. It's just this, it's wrestling. It's at some point, you got to say that there's no more excuse. You can actually do something. If he was not capable of doing anything, that would be one thing. But he is, and he's capable of doing a lot, and he's not doing it.
I kind of like us in here, and that way people can see that more, because they don't need to see us. You can hear us.
So for those who want to know what's going on in the Sunshine State, and there is obviously a lot going on here, because
I have some.
Why would we not have something going on?
I have some commentary.
The new legislative session has begun in earnest here in the Sunshine State. And of course, what is it that the supermajority GOP want to bring up for legislation? The stupidest of stupid stuff. Because why would we want to help people when we can just piss off the other side? Right?
Yeah. Well,
am I right? Am I right?
For God's sake.
Florida bill would ban talk of sexual orientation, gender identity in the classroom. Why would they do that, Jen? Why is that something that they see as being important?
Okay, so building upon a framework created with 2021's Parents' Bill of Rights, Florida lawmakers have proposed a new piece of legislation that would ban discussion of sexual orientation or gender identity in classrooms for kindergarten through seventh grade. Based on the Parents' Bill of Rights protections for the fundamental rights of parents to direct the upbringing, education, and care for their minor children, the newly proposed House Bill 1557 and companion Senate Bill 1834 would require schools to adopt procedures for notifying parents if there is a change in their students' welfare. Well, obviously that, what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah, again, a change in a student's welfare, you know, it's amazing. But here's the thing that I would say about this. And this is why... I agree with, obviously, Representative Ann Escamani and Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith. This is so pointless regarding all of the problems that exist right now. You know, when you think about the housing problem, you know, you want to talk about a child's welfare. Yeah. I don't think sexual orientation is anywhere near the top of the list of problems that exist that we could be focusing on to mitigate that problem.
I just, this is just,
this is just red meat to the evangelical right that we talk about that really runs the party.
But the thing is that it's just mean.
It is. Of course it's, like, it's callous.
And they put it out there as if, and it's funny because I've been through the public school system here. I have a kid in, that went through the public school system here. There's not like proponents of an LGBT agenda going on in the public school. It's not like they're out there, you know, like prompting kids and saying stuff. It's just a matter of being able to speak in what we're now talking about is accepting people.
I have like it's just, I have several friends that are part of the LGBTQ community, and I know ones that said that they knew they were gay when they were nine.
Oh yeah.
It's like to when you
they think this makes people be
you can't control, you know, this is the thing that's always so interesting about the GOP is that well, both sides suck, but this whole duality about you can't control Mother Nature. Well, you can't control Mother Nature when it comes to this. This is why there needs to be the separation of church and state. And unfortunately, this is Florida, and we have a huge problem with the evangelical right nationwide. But what you have in a state like this is really bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to parts of Central Florida in particular, there is a church on every street
corner.
You
know, what Bob, and that's something that's that bothers me about this, because they're talking about the parents' rights to raise their kid. Then don't send them to public school.
Yep.
Then homeschool your kids or send them to parochial school. That's an option that you have. But in a public school, we should be teaching science and facts.
But herein lies the problem. And this is one of the biggest problems with charter schools. See, we don't have a problem with privately funded charter schools. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But the money that is going into Tallahassee that should be going to properly fund
public education,
public education is being siphoned away and put into charter schools. That is the crime.
Well, and for profit. But this is, I mean, this is very disturbing, but it's not surprising. And also it's a distraction. It's a distraction kind for of being like, able to fight about stuff.
Kind of like the diversity M&Ms.
Yeah.
Don't allow yourself to be distracted by the stupidity, because that's what it is. You got to sit when you see it, know it, and move along. So on another note, as we were talking about with Michael, you know, what could we do to reduce our carbon footprint? Here's an idea. Could Florida turn off the sun? Advocates say a utility-backed bill imperils rooftop solar in the Sunshine State. Whereas we want people to actually conserve energy. No, this is even worse. They want to do the opposite.
Yes.
Thing. So they essentially, Jen, if you will.
I will. A bill moving through the state legislature backed by a powerful utility company.
Shocking.
I wonder who that could be.
FPL.
Would slash the financial benefits of rooftop solar panels. Opponents of the legislation, including environmental. What happened? Okay. Opponents of the legislation. Why does that happen to me? It like jumps.
Got all those ads.
It's the all ads. The ads?
Yeah.
That's very, very frustrating.
You're on CNN.
Including environmental stuff. Groups, solar builders in the state and the NAACP say if it passes, a fast-growing green power industry would be turned off overnight, casting a dark cloud over solar's prospects in the Sunshine State. Yeah. I could also add the League of Women Voters to that, because I know they are very, very much big proponents of solar. And this is something that I bet you anything will be on their agenda this year.
You know, it's funny you bring that up, because it reminds me of a great Simpsons episode
from one
of the best seasons, which was season 6, 94-95, the Who Shot Mr. Burns episode. And one of the central themes of that episode was building a massive, like almost like a metal umbrella, if you will, to block out the sun. And by doing that, requiring a 24/7 use of his nuclear power, thus massively increasing his bottom line and hurting all of, you know, wildlife, plant life. Who cares? As long as it's good for business, that's what it's all about. So, and so that's what this is all about.
So despite its recent growth, solar's foothold in Florida lags behind many states.
Shocking.
About 90,000 households are solar powered, which is 1% of all electric customers in the state. Florida ranks 21st in the country in solar residential systems per capita.
And we're the sunshine state.
It's not good.
We got to change. It's, totally
it's not good.
We
so
change that. So that's why
this is what happened. A draft version of the bill was delivered to her, was delivered by Florida Power and Light lobbyists on October 18th. So that's so nice of the NextEra Energy lobbyists to write our solar legislation. Their real beef is that homeowners are actually getting money back from the solar that they're getting their power from, that they can sell back, and they're not wanting to do that anymore.
Why would they? And so here we are. If that's sort of a
ahead of this year's legislative fight, Florida Power and Light and NextEra Energy donated $3 million to political campaigns and committees. Let's look and see how many of them are Democrats. They have given to both parties, but mostly to Republicans and GOP aligned groups. There you go.
The Republicans control 2/3 of the elected branches and have a super majority in the state overall. So of course they're going to give to the ones in power because incumbents win 9 out of 10 times. So that's what we're faced with now. And if that's not enough, the supermajority can grow even bigger at the federal level because Governor DeSantis pushes Florida redistricting map that heavily favors Republicans. What a surprise. Now we saw, thankfully, only in one other state that this has been attempted in. It was attempted in Ohio and it failed.
I do want to say that this is creating an intra-party problem, because his own party is not necessarily behind him on this in the state. So this is what's really interesting. There's definitely a conflict going back and forth. So he submitted his office submitted a new congressional map that heavily favors his party. The highly partisan offering pins Democratic leaning seats to three urban areas, Tampa, Orlando, and Miami, and gives Republicans the advantage of at least 18 of the 28 of the state.
This is exactly what just happened in Ohio. This is exactly what just happened in Ohio, and the Supreme Court shot it down.
But I do want to tell you something. So in reading this, I pulled up several different pictures of what his proposed map was, and not on none of them can I see District 23. It's either it's so close under 24 that you can't see it, or it's just, I don't know, but I'm telling you, I've zoomed in and there is no District 23.
So there's clear. I think it's safe to say that Governor DeSantis doesn't think very highly of our congressional representative. Not a surprise.
But this is not what's going to happen, because the legislature came back with its own sort of plan. That's not going to be the plan. Like, they're not on board with it. And he has heavy Republican legislature. So if they're not on board with it, that's a problem.
Yeah, I think that I think Wasserman Schultz will unfortunately still be a congressional representative. She was going on shows the other day complaining about her seat possibly. It was all about her, of course.
Please,
but, you know, yeah.
Let her seat go away.
But you see, somebody like her is going to make a backroom deal to make sure that it isn't her seat that goes. It'll have to be somebody else's. The one that is most likely to get clipped, unfortunately, is going to be Representative Al Lawson up in the Panhandle area. That's not a guarantee, but right now, that's the rumbling.
But they're going back and forth. This is the point. Yeah. And
Florida will be the last state to have.
I would actually like to see if anybody knows where we can find it, because the ones I've seen, I can't blow up enough to see. But I would love to see his proposed districts versus what the other part of his party, the legislature's proposed districts, and see what our district looks like under both, and see if it even matters.
All I would say to you guys, and thankfully so far, the legislative maps have actually been done pretty fairly. Definitely a lot more so than people thought.
They need to be convex, people. It's got to be convex.
Now, there's an organization in Michigan called Ungerrymandered. It is a completely independent body, and they basically drew a perfect map. And why? Because they have no interest in favoring one party over the other. And when that happens, what do you get? You get fair districts. We don't need either party. This is the whole thing about the voting rights bill that the Democrats, the John Lewis voting rights bill that they're trying to put forward. It is a bill that they are designing because they want it to benefit Democrats, not just benefit voters. And if that's not enough, as we always try to point out, there is nothing in the voting rights bill that has anything to do with primary voting. It's all about general election voting because in reality, they are not trying to make it easier for voters. They're just trying to make it easier for their voters. That is why when we have redistricting, it should be an independent commission in all 50 states. That's the way it should be done. It's not being done, but kudos to Michigan. We could learn a thing or two here.
Yeah. But and then not. We also highlighted that Vermont's going to all mail-in ballots, courtesy of their Republican governor.
And that's a Republican governor.
I would like to say, yes, Matt, I am a second-generation native Floridian from South Florida. I am extremely familiar with Carl Hyson. But yeah, for sure, definitely somebody that I grew up knowing his work.
And last but not least, a Florida woman survived being tackled by a black bear while walking her dog at night. I took off running, she says.
And okay, this is where I want to talk about this for a second. Okay. First of all, you don't run from a bear. You just don't do it. They're going to win. And depending on the type of bear, you get dead. Fortunately for her, it was a black bear, and black bears don't attack people, very infrequently hurt people. There is not a lot of bear there. They don't want people. Right? She's lucky. She got away with just a scratch. She ran and it pounced on her from behind and knocked her to the ground. And she ended up getting away the scratch. But here's the thing that really pisses me off the most.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Brown bears, not so safe.
They killed the bear. So Florida Fish and Wildlife said the woman was treated for non-life-threatening injuries on the scene and her dog was not harmed. The bear biologist darted the adult bear in the tree and humanely killed it per FWC policy to protect public safety. She was not even real. Like, people, if you run from most animals, they're going to come get you. Like, you look like you're,
it's like blood in the water.
Okay. So, and I get it. People panic. They don't know what to do. I get it. But I just feel like the killing of the bear should just not be a thing. These are not, like, if look up bear attacks, look up black bear attacks in people. They just, it's not their thing. They're not browns. They're not grizzlies. They're not polar bears. They're black bears. And the fact that it didn't really want anything to do with her and it just left, if that bear wanted her dead, she'd be dead. And instead, she didn't even have any major injuries. To me, that is a reason to not kill said bear. So the point is, people, don't run from the bears if you're east.
It also goes to show you what overdevelopment does.
They killed the bear.
Because we are in their ecosystem.
I can't.
Bears have places to live. They need places to live. We think that we are entitled to basically just pillage the earth.
And you know what's interesting? So in Asheville, for people who know that I like to go there in the summer, there's an area in Asheville called Kenilworth Forest. And I stayed there one time and it's amazing. It's like this little forest in the lake, but it's in Asheville. And there's bears in there. And the bears wear collars. They're collared because to protect them from people. If you got like busted shooting a collared bear, you're in deep trouble.
You're
in a bad way. So like they do it to protect the bears, even though I'd rather them not have to have collars. And nobody would run away from a bear and then they would kill the bear. Even like, I don't understand that. So yes, that's what happens in Florida. I don't know. It really pissed me off. Just saying. And I'm not saying that she deserved to have something horrible happen. It's very good that she didn't. But the point is that the bear didn't need to be killed.
We side with the animals. We do.
That bear could have had its way with her. And it, as soon as it realized what she was and what it was, they ran off. The bears, they are more of a danger to your bird feeders. And they also do bend metal. They're very strong.
You know, the funny thing is that if he had actually killed her, there would have been no way of getting to him. He would have just been off and, you know.
Oh, yeah. Nobody would know what that's the thing. He was just seriously, people, they do bend metal. You know, like how you could put like the metal with the bird feeder on it. They will bend the metal. They're very strong.
Yeah, bears
meaning that
strong.
Bear could have killed her. Yeah. And she didn't even have any life-threatening injuries.
I love watching bears in Alaska grab the
The salmon. Okay, first of all, those are brown bears or grizzlies.
And they
attack. And very aggressive.
Yes.
I am very specifically talking about black bears in the east down here and in North Carolina. They are not coming
and
after
like any,
you.
And like any type of wild animal, if you are by a grizzly bear that has cubs, You better not.
Well, and there were babies. There were babies. And that's the only reason that this bear even ran after her was there were babies nearby. Mm-hmm. So then they killed the bear. So now what happens to the babies? I just this is
we're just a very selfish culture, unfortunately.
I'm pro bear.
I'm pro bear too. So Wednesday.
What do we have?
Check.
What do we? Oh, is this like a surprise?
No, I wouldn't say it's a surprise. It's
am
just,
I supposed
I don't
to know
off the top of my head right now? But we want.
Oh, you didn't know? Okay. Want. So, oh, candidate Marcel Dixon is coming on. He is primarying Jim Clyburn.
That's big.
Big.
Huge.
Huge. Huge. So really, we need to really get behind him big time because that's really awesome. And we have Joe Sandberg.
If you guys don't know who Joe Sandberg is, he is a wealthy entrepreneur in California who is a huge advocate for progressive initiatives, particularly a living wage. He is somebody who ironically was the third person along with Nina Turner, Marianne Williamson, and himself as potential non-corporate progressives to run for president in 24, assuming that Bernie Sanders.
This is an entrepreneur, again. Right? So maybe this is someone who would get behind our sort of Mark Cuban entrepreneur.
Well, we're going to talk about that.
Independent media.
He's support. A very listen. This is a very wealthy guy, and
we you know, need those we like people to say on our
that
team.
They. We, you, well, we I call Mark Cuban a billionaire with a conscience. Joe Sandberg may not be a billionaire, but he's a wealthy guy, right. And he does have a conscience, and so. Those types of conversations are very important.
We need support for our platforms.
We need somebody to stop Jeff Bezos. We need somebody to stop Elon Musk. We need somebody to stop Mark Zuckerberg. And we especially need somebody to stop Bill Gates.
Okay, so next week, guys, next Monday, our candidate is Annette Tadeo, who is currently one of the Democrats running to run against Ron DeSantis for governor. So that's a really, that's a tall order. And I, look, I've met Annette. I know her. I like her. She's nice. And so we're going to talk with her next week. And then we are talking with Colonel Rob Manis.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this? I don't know who that is.
He is a conservative. He is.
Oh no, not a conservative.
He is a 32-year Air Force veteran and somebody who I think we might actually find a lot of common ground with on a number of things. So these conversations are very important. So long as we're having them, we are extending the olive branch. Why? Because overwhelmingly, people on the left do not extend olive branches to people on the right. They just don't.
No, not really.
And so we are going to buck that trend as we have with a number of others.
Yeah.
And we'll continue to do. Because if we are going to save ourselves, we are going to have to take the movie Don't Look Up as a perfect conclusion to this evening is not just a movie. It's a blueprint. So follow it.
Well, it's just people like if this is somebody who, let's say, would be interested in contributing to a community garden, I don't care what their party affiliation is.
Neither
so
do
like
I.
We are willing to work with anybody on any of the issues that we're pushing.
Agreed. And on that note, we will see you guys on Wednesday. Hope you enjoyed it. Have a good night.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.